You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Now it's a window into the Great Depression era. Buna Coburn Carlson was born in 1926. She lived in western Wisconsin, and she's written a collection of short stories called Farm Girl, a Wisconsin memoir. She goes by Bunny, and she shared her memories with WPR host Keely Baltina.
Those of us who didn't live through the Great Depression, we've heard many stories about the struggles. Reading your essays, I feel like your nostalgia, maybe your optimism. Why are you grateful for being a farm kid in Wisconsin during such hard times?
Probably because I learned such wonderful lessons that you don't have to be a victim, that you can find joy, that you can manage with what you have, that that you can go on, you can do things, you can make do, you can make the best of what you have.
Did you see people helping people?
Oh yes, that was the way we lived. The neighbors helped each other, and even the down and out neighbor who really lacked everything would be brought a loaf of bread, a dinner. People helped each other on the farm. If someone were injured, there was someone to help fill in. Yes, it was not a bad time. I think somehow those times brought out the best in people.
You write that you, as a kid, you had jobs to do to help out the family and the farm in the summertime, and that work was long and it was hot, but then you had time to do your own thing. What do you remember about those hours to yourself?
We played the wonderful old phonograph in the upstairs. We read, we raided Mother and Dad's old books and magazines. We, depending on who was friends with whom, we played with our brothers and sisters. We explored the entire farm. As I say, we were free range, like the chickens.
Well, those chickens you mentioned too, and I think that resonates with a lot of farm kids, annoying the chickens and chasing the barn cats. That was part of your day.
Yes, that's right. And then, of course, we did have our jobs to do. And when they were done, Mother and Dad were very, very generous with us. We were able to explore. If we wanted to just sit and daydream, that was okay too.
Oh, you didn't always have to be moving.
No.
You mentioned the phonograph, and you talk about in your writing that one of your favorites was literally a broken record. Why was that special to you?
Because of the music that was on it. I loved the Dvorak's New World Symphony. The part that was on that particular record was the Going Home song, which is haunting and lovely, and apparently other people felt that same longing that it produces.
And you know other people loved it because it had a chunk out of it, a chip out of it, so you had to be careful with it, right?
That's right, yes. Oh, the records were so scratched and raspy. I'm surprised that we got anything out of them. But we played them over and over and over. And it was not battery powered or electricity powered. It was crank handle powered. So it was available all the time. We didn't have to wait for the battery to be recharged. There was, of course, no electricity. So no electric devices were available to us. But that was okay. We loved that photograph.
Food often shows up in your stories, learning to cook, baking for threshing day dinner, eating what you had, especially in the summertime, but all year round. What's the connection between your memories and food?
Well, everything that appeared on the table pretty much came from the farm. We had a part in raising it, in harvesting it, in picking it, and preserving it. So food was pretty important. And we were very fortunate to have farm produce. There were a lot of hungry people who did not have that. So we counted our blessings and helped with the harvesting, preparation, and enjoyment of the food as we had it. I didn't learn a lot about cooking at home. I watched my mother. I didn't participate as much as my sister did. She was more the indoor girl, and I was the outdoor kid. I did help with some of the, like canning corn or canning the pickles, the cucumbers. We kids helped when we could, but mother was the major domo in the kitchen.
Bunny Carlson grew up in western Wisconsin during the Great Depression. Her recent memoir called Farm Girl is a collection of short stories, short essays she's written about those times. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Bunny, one of the stories you have in your collection is called Uphill Both Ways, and most of us recognize that as part of a joke that people tell kids about how hard their lives were when they were little and that they had to walk to school uphill both ways. It wasn't exactly that bad, but your walk, it was long. What do you remember about those walks to school in Wisconsin winters in the 30s?
Well, I remember how cold it was, how bone-chilling cold it was, and the snow. Sometimes the wind had blown the snow off the road, but other times it was drifted across the road, and when the snowplow came through, sometimes it had to be the big caterpillar with cleats and lugs and big treads that left the road as unpleasant for walking as if they had not been plowed.
In the same story about walking to school, you write that for years during the Depression, your family had a car, but they didn't use it. Why?
They couldn't afford to operate it, couldn't afford gasoline, couldn't afford repairs, couldn't afford tires, couldn't afford, I'm not sure if the insurance was required at that time, but I assume there was something. But there was no way they could afford to operate it. At least 2 years, maybe three, early in the Depression.
You write that your parents made less than $700 a year once running the farm during one of those years. What did you see them sacrifice?
Oh, my mother never had new clothes. She made her dresses. She patched Dad's overalls to the point where the patches had patches. And those patches came from worn-out overalls, so they were not very sturdy. Yeah, it was a struggle, but it was not an unhappy life. Mother and Dad were optimistic, had a strong belief that they were capable and they could manage, and they did.
Where do you think they found that strength?
I don't know what kind of an inner strength they had, but they lived through disaster and they drew on some kind of an inner strength that I don't know. I don't know.
Have you found as the years have gone on that you've had to tap into some of that kind of inner strength, that you've looked to them as an example?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes, and I think people right now are finding the same kind of experience that we had in the Great Depression. The Depression left us with no resources, no money. People were hungry. And now people are having the same kind of difficulties, but due to the pandemic. And they're finding the same kind of inner resources if they choose to.
Bunny, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you for caring about this book.
And that was WPR host Keely Baltina talking with author Bunny Carlson. Bunny's new book is called Farm Girl, a Wisconsin Memoir. Coming up, we talk with Democratic Representative Mark Pocan. He's on the line from Wisconsin's congressional delegation. Do you support more stimulus checks, more federal aid for businesses, or raising the minimum wage? What do you think of the Equality Act? 800-642-1234 to join in. Back in a minute with Congressman Pocan here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have Representative Mark Pocan on the line now to discuss Democrats' COVID relief legislation and the Equality Act that has passed the House, sweeping legislation protecting people from being discriminated upon based on sexual orientation or gender identity. What do you think of the Equality Act? Where do you stand on a stimulus package and what President Biden is proposing? $1.9 trillion in relief. It's 800-642-1234. Mark Pocan is a Democratic U.S. representative from Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District. Representative Pocan, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks, Kate. Glad to be here.
Well, we'll start first with the $1.9 trillion package and then move to the Equality Act. So Biden's COVID relief could set in motion a third stimulus check for up to $1,400. Are stimulus checks the answer for reviving our economy?
You know, I think it's the package that's out there. You know, we needed to do a lot more last year. We passed a bill back in May, the HEROES Act, and then nothing happened in the Senate until late in the fall. And, you know, that was a lot of time lost when the economy needed help. And because of that, we're still going to be struggling as we're getting the vaccines out. So I do think that both the recovery checks, the support for small business, the support for frontline workers, the ability to get the vaccine out, the protection for renters. I mean, all the components are what we need so that we can actually get our heads back up from under COVID-19. It's essential the vaccines get out, but it's also essential that we get the economy coming back as we're doing that.
Well, specifically on the vaccine front, how would this package fix the issue of vaccine shortages that we're seeing around the country and here in Wisconsin?
Well, much of the shortages we have now found out have happened because of the last presidential administration. They had no plan for distribution. They had no reserve plan. And, you know, much of the production had to start kind of from scratch. But the good news is in a couple weeks, that should largely be taken care of. But you still have to provide the resources to local and state government, who are really in many ways are providing much of the vaccines and the support to people who need that. So, you know, there's a lot that has to happen, a lot of moving pieces. This bill covers those moving pieces, and I am fully convinced that this will pass through the House and the Senate in some form in the next several weeks. We have to get it out by mid-March because that's when the unemployment extra assistance runs out, and I think that's also crucial to our recovery.
March 14th, yeah. The Senate's top rule enforcer, the parliamentarian, said the $15 an hour minimum wage increase could not be included in the COVID relief bill. Do you expect that House Democrats will drop the wage hike from your version of the bill?
No, because it shouldn't be. I think one of the sillier things and one of the reasons that I don't fully love the Senate and how it operates is because of silly things like the 60-vote rule they have and things like this, where a parliamentarian, an unelected individual, can decide if something is more fiscal or not. That's very arbitrary. They're not elected by the people. So, you know, if I was the senators, I would overrule that. I would take a vote and say no. People who are hurting the most are those who are on the lowest end of the wage scale. We have to do this to help those folks through COVID relief and to help stimulate the economy. And, you know, I would move ahead. But the Senate operates under very different rules at a very different pace. And, you know, we're not going to make the mistake that the Senate appears to be making with an individual deciding this who's unelected. So we're moving forward today. And by the end of today, we will have sent the bill to the Senate.
We're talking with Congressman Mark Pocan about the $1.9 trillion relief package. He's a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District. You can join in with your questions about the package, 800-642-1234. Dan is joining us from Frankville. Hi, Dan. Go ahead.
Howdy. I think that we're past the point of the economy coming back. The banks, since 2008, the banks have basically been insolvent. They probably shouldn't have been bailed out because all the money that's been put into them, they got all the derivatives on the books and stuff like that. Deutsche Bank is sort of failing right now, but we need a WPA so we know what's happened in the past. And so what we need is a jobs program because the private market is not going to back us up. All the jobs have moved overseas, and this giving out free money is, I mean, it might work short term, but all we're going to do is we're going to start seeing inflation and the jobs are not coming back.
Dan, thanks. Representative, we need a massive jobs program in America.
You know, Dan's right, and that can happen in two ways. The next big package will likely be an infrastructure package that will create good family-supporting jobs and fix our desperately needed infrastructure. So that, I think, will be the very next larger package you'll see if you go through Congress. But, you know, he's right. There's things we need to do to bring jobs back to the United States. I think what we learned from the COVID crisis was, you know, many of our medicines, many of our PPE, many of everything is made overseas because, unfortunately, corporations decided paying people pennies on the dollar was more profitable. But at the end, that's a security risk for the United States in many areas. So I think that's another area many of us are talking about, how we can best incentivize those jobs to be able to come back. Obviously, they're not all going to come back, but he makes some very solid points about having this done in a more comprehensive structural way.
What about schools? Many schools in Wisconsin are preparing to go back to the classroom. Last month, President Biden supported providing K-12 schools and colleges $170 billion to safely reopen. Does the House agree with that amount for education?
Well, what we have said is we want to also have our schools reopen, but we want to do it safely. And that's why this bill, the $1.9 trillion, is so important, because it gives a lot of money to schools to be able to do some of the ventilation things they need to do, some of the other protections they need to have in place so that you can reopen schools safely. So, again, the good news is I think this bill will be passed in a matter of weeks and we can start getting those resources out. But everyone wants to see us restore to normal, but we have to do it safely, and we can't put our teachers and custodial staff and others at risk, and that's why these dollars are so important.
The Equality Act. The House yesterday approved the Equality Act, which is meant to prevent businesses from discriminating against people based on sexual orientation and gender identity. Does it go far enough? Is this bill enough to protect LGBTQ Americans?
Well, you know, the good news, Kate, is 83%, I believe, is the number of people, percent of the people in the United States support this. So the good news is we have seen amazing progress in what has been an area where people have been discriminated against for far too long. The Equality Act at least makes sure that under the law, we wouldn't have people being discriminated against, and we passed it out of the House yesterday. What's odd, though, is because the Republican Party in Congress now has this QAnon vibe, you know, the Tea Party now are the moderates, which is a pretty scary thought. And the Republican Party is in a civil war. They don't quite know how to behave like a political party again. So there was a lot of strange rhetoric. There was a lot of moves to adjourn. There was a lot of Q-ness going on that unfortunately shouldn't have tainted something that has wide popular public support and is needed legally to make sure there's not discrimination.
Let's look at that a little closer. Your Republican colleague Mike Johnson of Louisiana called the Equality Act dangerous and an attack on religious liberty. Is this an attack on religion?
That's where the idiocy of the debate, the Q-ness of the debate yesterday took off. It treats everyone the same under the law. So that's the whole point, is no matter if you're LGBTQ or heterosexual, you are treated the same under the law. So there is no discrimination based on religion on behalf of the LGBT community. There's no extra rights. It's just everyone has the same rights. That's the type of rhetoric twisting we saw happening on the floor.
Some believe it would threaten the existence of women, prisoners, public school girls, locker rooms. You know, how can women remain protected under this act?
Yeah, again, the debate was silly. It wasn't about whether or not you should be able to legally discriminate against someone who's gay or lesbian, bisexual, or transgender. It became a guy might want to pretend he's a woman in order to win women's sports. It's a crazy made-up fantasy notion that only, you know, could come out of a Q Republican Party. But it doesn't have any grounding in reality. So we tried to keep the debate to reality. Let's make sure that we treat everyone with respect and dignity. This isn't, Iran or Somalia where you can be put to death for homosexual acts. This is the United States of America. Let's provide that opportunity and safety and protection to everyone.
Representative Pocan, thank you for joining us. And that was Mark Pocan, Democratic U.S. Representative from the 2nd Congressional District. Back after this news update. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. This month marks the program's 10th anniversary on WPR. And as part of the celebration, here's Wisconsin Life host Maureen McCollum reflecting on one of her favorite stories about a winter sport.
This month, we're celebrating 10 years of Wisconsin Life on WPR. To honor this milestone, I've asked some of our producers to choose their favorite stories to share with our listeners. Then it came time for me to choose my favorite story. How can I choose a favorite? I really love them all. But there was one story that felt perfect for this moment. Ladies and gentlemen, I take you to a night of broomball in lacrosse.
Come on, Jake. Boards, boards.
Broomball is a lot like ice hockey, except players wear shoes and use a ball instead of a puck. The game originated in Canada in the early 20th century and eventually made its way to lacrosse, where bar-sponsored teams play weekly during most winters. This story brings me so much joy. It shows how Wisconsinites are so resilient and will do anything to stay active and happy in the winter. Plus, this is one of the few times I've featured my friends in a story. I've done thousands of stories in my life, and only like two or three of them includes a friend. And I really, really miss my friends right now. Hearing their voices warms my heart, and it reminds me that one day this pandemic will pass, and we can get back to our normal lives, cheering each other on, doing the weird things we all love to do in Wisconsin. I hope you enjoy your journey with me to a night of broomball in lacrosse.
Mike Brogan. Basically, I'm kind of the coordinator for the league. My other job is park and recreation director for Holman. I've been playing since 1990. Broomball is essentially kind of hockey rules, a little slimmed down and made a little easier. We use a kind of a mini soccer ball that's about the size of a softball. You use a broom, but it's not really a broom anymore. It used to be brooms. Actually, there's a few players that still have brooms at play, but they're mostly kind of a molded head. But without skates, so you're running on the ice. Most of the players would have broomball shoes, which most of the world doesn't know what those are, but they're quite unique with kind of a Chuck Taylor type of look with the big spongy bottom.
Go ahead, Rachel.
My full name is Rachel Leering, and I'm playing for the Animal House team. I officially started 5 years ago, and I actually played for our rivals, John's team. I like to play broomball because it's definitely a great activity in the wintertime when normally people just mope on their couches and watch TV all winter or sit in the bars, and this way you actually get out and get some exercise sweat yourself up, and it's fun. And it's nice because I'm a little competitive, so having a nice sport in the winter is kind of nice to bring that out.
Come on, Nick, clear it out.
Nick Fallons. I got icicles on my eyebrows right now. That's why I love broomball. It could be 30 below, but you're still sweating outside. And plus, anybody can play it. Anybody from 18 to, look at Jane out there. She's probably 42. And if you get sweet jerseys like we do, you win every game.
Use it. Hey, House.
My name's Louis Parrish, and I've been playing broomball for, I think this will be my fourth year. I play for the Animal House, which is a bar downtown La Crosse. a lot of times go after the game. It's really fun. I used to play hockey too, so it's real similar to hockey, which I like.
He likes to throw cheap shots out there.
Yeah, that's the opponent talking smack. Usually typical when he's down. So yeah, there's a lot of John in this game, but for the most part, everybody's friends and it's a good time. Even when it's negative 30 out, it's still fun to get out here. Well, it looks like I got to go out in the ice. So.
My name is Pat Scheller. I play for John's Bar, the oldest established brew ball team in the city. I've been playing for 33 years.
Right back, Pat. Right back.
My favorite brew ball story? I think the fact that I have been ejected several times. And I've played with people 30 years ago that I'm still friends with, and I'm making new friends this year. I think that's what I like. And I'm 56 years old, and I'm outside doing something in the middle of the winter, 5 degrees above zero.
That was a night of broom ball in La Crosse, recorded back in 2013. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And now, the future of mail delivery in America. Oshkosh Defense announced this week that the U.S. Postal Service awarded it a contract worth hundreds of millions of dollars to make new electric battery mail trucks. Also, Postmaster General Louis DeJoy was peppered with questions from a House oversight panel about the Postal Service's financial woes. Here's DeJoy.
In our strategy, if we in fact get the relief that we need in terms of time, we will put more mail on the ground. And I will tell you that a big, big reason for our service performance failures this peak season had to do that our air carriers performed at 50 to 60%.
Are you more dependent on the post office this year? What have you relied on it for? Do you think the government should protect the Postal Service and provide more funding or let competition win out the day? 800-642-1234. Jacob Bogage is a business reporter for The Washington Post. Jacob, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the Postmaster General DeJoy, he previously testified before Congress in the fall as concerns were mounting over the lengthy delays in the delivery of paychecks and medication, other critical mail. What was different this time in testimony this week?
We had an election, which is what was different. The last time Louis DeJoy testified was on my birthday, August 24th, and the big issue then was he had just enacted a series of policy changes about how the mail was going to be handled, and that unleashed a whole lot of chaos. Mm-hmm. And we've seen reports that, you know, from congressional offices that have done the studies, that it delayed more than 7% of the nation's mail, Louis DeJoy's changes over the summer alone. And so that was the backdrop to this hearing in August, which was, why did you do what you did? Did you know what effect it would have on the mail? Did you know what effect it could have on the election? And what are you doing to make things better for the election? Because a whole lot of us are going to vote by mail. This time around, we had our election. We've had some space between what Louis DeJoy did over the summer and now. But we also had a really awful holiday season for the mail. We have folks who are getting bills late and are getting late fees, or their credit scores are getting dinged, or they're getting their prescription medications late, which is obviously problematic. There are still tremendous service issues that they wanted to hold the Postmaster General accountable for. And Louis DeJoy is also promising the unveiling of his 10-year plan for the Postal Service. And parts of that plan have started to leak out, especially in my reporting. And they wanted to see what was in this plan. And Louis DeJoy was not very forthcoming about that.
What does DeJoy envision? What is the forecast for mail in our country?
So we know a few things. One is your mail is going to get more expensive. And this is not, you know, some scoop that I have. This is something he has said publicly. The Postal Service's postage rates are normally tied to inflation. That's why a stamp only goes up a few cents every few years. Mm-hmm. Over the summer, a couple months ago, the Postal Regulatory Commission, which oversees the Postal Service's rate making process, authorized the Postal Service to no longer raise prices strictly commensurate with inflation. So there's a new formula that they authorized. And Louis DeJoy has said that the Postal Service plans to take advantage of that new formula. So, you know, when we look at the postal calendar and all the things they have to apply for and get approval for, that rate change should probably be coming around July. So that's one. Two is your mail's going to slow down. And this is not slow down based on what you're experiencing now. This is slow down based on the Postal Service's expectations that they set. So if you send something locally, it should take like 2 days to get there. If you send something non-locally to the rest of the country, it should take 3 to 5 days. Obviously, that is not what people are experiencing now because there are so many delays in the system. But one of the plans that I've reported on and that the Postmaster General seemed to confirm in testimony on Wednesday was the expectations are going to change. We're going to get rid of two-day mail. Everything, no matter where you send it, is going to be 3 to 5 day. We're not going to put mail on airplanes anymore to go across the country, which is really going to slow down the network. And that has a lot of mailing industry folks concerned.
Yeah, what is this whole deal about flying the mail versus not flying it? And what are the savings there?
The savings are significant to you and me. I mean, based on, you know, the math that me and my sources have done, that would be like $250 billion. But you have to remember, excuse me, million dollars, not okay. No, billion. I'm right. Billion. sorry about that, Kate.
It's okay.
So that's significant annually, 250 million. It is million. You know what? There's too many illions in my head. $250 million. You know, that would be significant, but you also have to remember, like, I would like to have that money, but you also have to remember that the Postal Service's financial liabilities are $188 billion. So, yeah, that's going to save them a lot, but in the grand scheme of things, it's really a drop in the bucket. And the concern among, you know, industry experts is, okay, you're saving money, but you're also degrading service. And is that going to cost you in the long run because mailers aren't willing to pay more for less and are going to take their business elsewhere or they'll push online? There's a real concern about what the Postal Service thinks will remain in the system and continue giving them revenue and what revenue will leave and won't come back.
Meanwhile, President Biden nominates three people to sit on the U.S. Postal Service Governing Board. What would the responsibilities of these people include?
It includes reinvigorating internal accountability and oversight for the Postal Service. And that was another major theme of this hearing on Wednesday. The new chairman of the Board of Governors, Ron Blum, who's a Democrat, was in front of the board and was really pressed on, do you continue to support Louis DeJoy? Do you support this 10-year plan, some details of which we know? Do you support a price increase? Do you see all of these things? And there was some, especially from the left, some significant anger that Blum seemed to dodge some of these questions, but also said that the Postmaster General is in a really difficult set of circumstances, but we think he's doing a good job. And there was some disagreement there.
Talking with Jacob Bogage, business reporter for The Washington Post, covers the financial hurdles of the U.S. Postal Service. Do you see the designs for the new fleet of mail trucks? What do you think of these designs? How do you feel about your delivery of your mail and what it may cost you now and in the future? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Jacob Bogage here on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation about the U.S. Postal Service and the embattled Postmaster General, Louis DeJoy, who told a House panel Wednesday to get used to him. He's not going anywhere. USPS has reported billions in annual net losses in recent years. Jacob Bogage is a business reporter for The Washington Post covering the fallout. He's with us for about 10 more minutes. Let's bring in Mary now in Milwaukee. Hi, Mary.
Good morning, Kate.
Good morning. What would you like to say?
I guess I'm a little confused because DeJoy's expertise apparently is logistics. So how does he feel that delaying the mail going from one side of Milwaukee to the other side now takes 3 days? So I guess I'm losing that translation from how that it's saving the post office money. And what his intentions are, it's almost like, again, he's pushing customers away to go online and pay versus actually coming into a post office, purchasing a book of stamps, which is where we make revenue, and this other way.
Mary, thank you. Jacob, what do you make of that, especially on the logistics front?
I think that's a great point, and it's something that we really don't have a strong answer for. I mean, something that Louis DeJoy talked about in his testimony was the struggles of the Postal Service's network. He said, look, if we can get mail to what we call a delivery unit, that's basically your post office, or to the hands of your letter carrier, who's going to put that mail in their truck and then drive out to your street and put the mail in your mailbox. If we can do that, we're really, really good at our job. Where we struggle is getting the mail from point A to point B through our processing system, through the machines, through all of this stuff, into your letter carrier's hands. That's really problematic because that's the job, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, obviously we rely on the Postal Service for delivery, but the job does not begin and end there. You have to pick the mail up. You have to sort the mail. You have to process the mail. You have to put it on transportation to get it where it's going. I mean, I think that's a really great point and one that we don't really have firm answers on. And just like Mary, I think the members of Congress had a really hard time kind of understanding this is the vast majority of what you do. So tell us exactly where the disconnect is. I think that was something that we didn't get answered. And there's a lot of, you know, talking to my sources on Capitol Hill, a lot of dissatisfaction there.
Mary, thanks. Let's bring in Chris now in Milwaukee. Chris, hi, go ahead.
Hi. I'm sorry. This is how I see it. For the leadership on the right, the preferred outcome for the post office is its elimination. And that way we can have privatized mail service. Now, that's a really great idea. We can treat it just like, I don't know, Texas Energy. I'll listen off the air.
Or, you know, Chris is saying there that competition, privatizing mail service is what Republicans are really after here. What do you find, Jacob?
So the conservative, or at least some conservatives' priority for the Postal Service is not this pure privatization. It's not saying let's create companies that will deliver the mail or some private public partnership that will deliver the mail. It's elements of privatization. So it's contracting out some mail processing work. It's contracting out some delivery work or transportation in between, which the Postal Service already does with transportation. So it's not this pure privatization. That is really concerning to organized labor groups. It's really concerning to privacy advocates and consumer advocates who say the people who should look at your mail are public servants and public servants only.
So, but with increased competition, wouldn't that improve service and, you know, elevate everyone? I mean, isn't competition good?
I don't know if that's for me to say. I mean, I think the Postal Service has a really complex relationship with its competitors who are mainly FedEx and UPS and Amazon even. They, by law, cannot carry the mail, but they can carry packages. And they do not have the distribution networks, the nationwide distribution networks that the Postal Service has. They're really good, but they're not what the Postal Service has. And so they will give the Postal Service a lot of their packages. Your Amazon Prime packages, for example, Amazon is not the one dropping them off at your door a lot of the time. They're handing them to the Postal Service and saying, hey, can you bring this to Chris, please? Can you bring this to Mary? And by the way, it's got to go out today because we have a delivery guarantee. So we really need you to do that. The privatization and competition arguments and skeptics and advocates, they're really locked in this very complicated dance. And I think if Chris is concerned about privatization, maybe she can sleep a little easier knowing that there is such an interconnected relationship that pure privatization is, even for those folks on the far, far right, is not a realistic policy objective, and they realize that.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Jacob Bogage, who's a business reporter for The Washington Post. You can join in. How well do you know your postal carrier? Do you know them by name? Tell us about them and the job they do. 800-642-1234. Jacob, early this week, they announced a $482 million contract with Oshkosh Defense here in our neck of the woods to design new energy-efficient mail trucks. So what does this plan look like?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, congrats to your Oshkoshians, or I imagine that's got to be exciting. $482 million to purchase up to 165,000 vehicles. These vehicles are so sorely needed. They're replacing trucks that are older than me. And I'm 26, so they're replacing these really old trucks. They don't have air conditioning. They don't have radios. They are known to light on fire because they've been around for so long. I've had people tell me the steering column came off while I was in the middle of driving it. So, like, these are really, really old beat-up things that are aptly named long-life vehicles, and this is the end of their long life. What we're looking at now is a truck that's, first of all, engineered to be more fuel efficient, and 10% of those trucks will be electric. And that's great, but at the same time, there's a lot of folks saying 10% is not a whole lot. We need to up that number. They're also completely kind of redesigned on the inside, not just to be like ergonomic and better for workers, but also that you can fit more boxes in this thing instead of just envelopes. It's easier to move around for a postal worker to be able to get to the back of the truck instead of having to get out of the truck and open the latch at the back of the truck and reach inside. I mean, they should just be easier to work with. And everyone asks me, what do you think they look like? To me, I think they look like rubber duckies, but that's just me.
Of course, I was just about to ask you that so we could get the vision in our head with its little cute duck beak. So
in the postal industry, the trucks you see on the older trucks you see on the street right now, they call them milk cartons because they look like milk cartons. I don't know what the term is that's going to catch on for these, but I would prefer duckmobile.
So what is next? What are you watching for in the future developments here?
So a few things. Let's stay on the trucks for a minute. I'm definitely looking to see if the Postal Service will get pressed to make more of these trucks electric, especially in light of President Biden's recent executive order. So that's one. Two, Louis DeJoy said his 10-year plan is coming out in March. But they have also consistently said since like the summer, our plan is imminently about to come out. So we'll see if it really does come out in March. But I want to see the full details of that plan. Third, I want to know the future of Louis DeJoy and the future of the leadership of the Postal Service, which is very much in question.
Jacob, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
Jacob Bogage, business reporter for The Washington Post. Just ahead, we learn about Wisconsin's LGBTQ community and the state's recent gay history. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.